Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. Once upon a time, there was a great big elephant, and his name was Jumbo. And they didn't name him Jumbo because he was a great big elephant, but rather we used the word Jumbo to describe things that are big because this big elephant was named Jumbo. And tonight, Paul Chambers is my guest, and he has just written a marvelous tiny little volume about a great big elephant, and it's called Jumbo, This Being the True Story of the Greatest Elephant in the World. Paul Chambers' previous books include A Sheltered Life, The Unexpected History of the Giant Tortoise. Paul Chambers, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So, Jumbo. Would you say that Jumbo is the first animal superstar in popular culture?
It's a difficult one to say that, actually. Yes, I think certainly the first international superstar. From my various ramblings in history, that there have been sort of other animals that have made a stir in various locations, but Jumbo was certainly the first one that made it big in several countries, most notably Britain and America. So, yes, I would say he's the first superstar, yes.
And although, you know, of course, he's an animal because he's an elephant, but you do speak of him, and the people who speak of him in the book speak of him, I guess person is the wrong word, but as an intelligent being, certainly.
He was intelligent, certainly. And had a very strong personality, and that comes through from the moment people start writing about him in any real sense. You know that this elephant has got a very strong personality. He's a very no-nonsense character who was prone to these sort of fits of temper. If he didn't get his way, he would quite regularly destroy his surroundings and things if people didn't do the things he wanted him to do. So, yes, he was a very very strong personality, and also, which I suppose is perhaps more important, he was also surrounded by human beings who also had very strong personalities. And of course, when you get lots of strong personalities together, strange things happen.
Was he born in the wild? Jumbo was born in the wild?
He was born in the wild. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, really. He was the first African elephant to make it to Europe in, I think, 2,000 years since Roman times. So he was actually born in what is now Eritrea, what was then the sort of borderlands between Abyssinia and Sudan in Africa, and was captured at about 1 year old. And it was one of the things I suppose I was most proud of, really, with the book was his origins had been disputed, quite heavily disputed, actually, and some people said he had come from South Africa, and there are other rumors that he'd been part of a traveling circus and all kinds of things like that. And I was very, very lucky to stumble across the memoirs of a rather eccentric British explorer named Samuel White, who, and it's a real bit of coincidences, who actually bumped into Jumbo about 2 or 3 days after he'd been captured. He'd been captured by some tribesmen in this sort of rather lawless borderland area. And Samuel White bumped into the tribesmen afterwards. And really, once I discovered this, I was able to trace Jumbo's roots. He was sold by the tribesmen to an animal dealer and then force-marched across the Sahara Desert and then taken by boat up the Red Sea and all kinds of horrible things like that. I was able to trace his route back into Europe. So, yes, he was wild-born, and although obviously he was tamed to a degree, he retained a lot of his wild personality, I think, throughout his life.
Approximately how old was he when they captured him?
He would have been roughly 12 months old, give or take. He would have still been with his mother. We know from Samuel White that the tribesmen there killed Jumbo's mother, and that they were very skilled. They're actually called elephant hunters, these tribesmen. They were Arabic tribesmen that operated within this part of Africa, and they had a very sort of specialist way of, and rather gruesome way of killing elephants on horseback, because it was a very risky thing to do, obviously, to kill an elephant. And the way they used to do it was two or three of them would get together with horses, persuade the elephant to charge at them, and then whilst the elephant was charging at one or two of the horsemen, one of the others would come round the back with a very sharp knife, and this is going to be a bit gruesome, I'm afraid, and actually sort of cut their hamstrings on the back of their legs so that they fell over and eventually bled to death. And unfortunately, that's what happened to Jumbo's mother. Jumbo was captured and then taken to Europe and then sold to a zoo. So he was in Paris for a little while and then went across to London.
So of all the people who claimed ownership of Jumbo at various times in his life, none of them were particularly kind to him.
It's a difficult one. I think they looked after him perfectly well in terms of his... Well, actually, that's not true. The first zoo he was at, which was in Paris, he was really quite abysmally treated. They just weren't that interested in him, even though he was the first African elephant to come to Europe in 2,000 years. They just weren't interested, and they shoved him in a very overcrowded elephant house already and completely neglected him. And he was rescued by the superintendent of London Zoo, who had been trying for years and years. He had a thing about African elephants and was desperate to get one for his zoo and been trying to get one for years and years. And when he finally persuaded the Paris Zoo to let him have Jumbo, the description he gives of the state of this animal when he arrived finally in London, you know, he was disease-ridden. His entire coat was scabby and infested in things. And it actually took them the best part of 6 months to get him back into some sort of health. So he was very badly looked after physically at first, but afterwards, after that, everyone looked after him physically fine. I think the problem was that all the people that Jumbo came into contact with had a sort of an ulterior motive with him. So they looked after his physical needs quite well, but they rather tended to exploit him. I suppose a bit like some modern celebrities. He was used by other people for their own means, rather than, you know, they didn't quite have his best interests at heart. So it was a little bit unfortunate.
Did he have tusks when he came to London?
He was just developing tusks, but the problem with old Jumbo was, unfortunately, he had this habit. He was very temperamental and would occasionally have these extraordinary fits of temper that would see him quite literally destroy his den or his elephant house. You know, he'd break all the windows, and as he got bigger and stronger, he sometimes even sort of demolished doors and walls and things. And one of the things he used to do, it sounds almost as though it was out of spite, and I suppose it might have been, was to deliberately wear down his tusks as they grew. He would grind them against the wall. So, unfortunately, he never had the sort of magnificent tusks that you see modern African elephants with, and indeed a lot of zoo elephants have tusks. But Jumbo, again, probably a measure of his strong personality, decided that tusks weren't for him, and he wore them down.
He bashed them against the side of the wall or whatever?
Yeah, bashed them against the wall, and sometimes, you know, he would bash them so hard that they would splinter and then you know, they'd become infected and things, and then you've got all kinds of horrible, you know, the poor old elephant keeper had to try and sort that out, you know, he just never had tusks. In all the illustrations, I mean, there are good illustrations of him right from the moment he arrived in London in 1865, and he just you never see an illustration of Jumbo with tusks.
And he had one keeper pretty much the whole time he was in London?
Yes. Most extraordinary story. It's a guy called Matthew Scott, who was a loner, a very strange character, actually. I mean, he'd been at the zoo for a number of years, and he looked after the deer and things there. And he was a very odd chap. He hated human company. He loved his animals, and indeed he was obsessed with animals, but absolutely disliked humans and really didn't go much of a bundle for them at all. And the superintendent of the zoo, Abraham Bartlett, when he finally got his African elephant, when he finally got Jumbo, he purposefully put Matthew Scott in charge of him because Matthew Scott had never handled an elephant before. And Abraham Bartlett thought, well, if I put someone who knows nothing about elephants in charge of an elephant, I will be able to direct him. So rather than, it's a bit of an odd way of saying it, but rather than have an elephant keeper, one of his experienced elephant keepers look after Jumbo, he wanted someone who wasn't experienced, because Bartlett wanted to have a share in the running too. But Scott soon became obsessed with Jumbo and really refused anyone else, almost refused anyone to have access to him in some ways. And the two became incredibly close, particularly because Scott saved Jumbo's life. He became very ill for a while, and the zoo thought that Jumbo was going to die. And Scott actually shut himself away in the elephant house for days and days, didn't sleep for days and days, and nursed Jumbo back to health. And afterwards, Jumbo wouldn't leave Scott's side for more than a few minutes, and indeed Scott wouldn't leave Jumbo's side for more than a few minutes. I mean, I've been through all the zoo's records and things, and the keepers there were entitled to one Sunday off a month, and Scott didn't take a single holiday from the moment he met Jumbo. For the next 16 years, didn't take a single day off, because the elephant wouldn't be parted from him, and indeed he wouldn't be parted from the elephant. So much so that they used to do things like get drunk together at night. They'd take a bottle of, Scott would take a bottle of whiskey or bottles of ale into the elephant house, and they'd get drunk and then start singing together, which, of course, because a lot of the keepers and the superintendent all lived in the zoo itself, this sort of drunken elephant trumpeting and singing and things used to wake the entire zoo up.
The elephant would be drunk as well?
Sorry?
The elephant would be drunk as well?
Oh, yes. Poor old Jumbo. I mean, I was making a comparison with celebrities earlier. I'm afraid he had a drink habit as well.
He needed rehab.
And in fact, he on his arrival in New York in 1882, the first thing he did was grab a bottle of whiskey off someone who was standing there and down the whole thing in one go. So, yes, it's a bit unfortunate, and obviously these days you would never put alcohol anywhere near an animal, but in those days it just wasn't seen as being that odd. You know, if the elephant liked a bit of whiskey or a bit of beer, that's what you'd give them. But he did have this incredible relationship with Scott, but it turned sour in the end, because Scott was a very controlling man. He was obsessed with his own self-importance. And when Jumbo became famous in London, and he became very, very famous, he was a superstar in the true sense of the word in London, because Jumbo would only take instructions from Scott, he started to blackmail London Zoo, because he, if the zoo did something that Scott didn't like, he would then make sure that sort of Jumbo went on strike, or that Jumbo accidentally destroyed a bit of the zoo or something like that. we can go on to this in a bit if you like, but that was actually one of the reasons why London Zoo decided to sell Jumbo in the end. And it wasn't so much that they wanted to get rid of the elephant, because actually the elephant was their star attraction. One of the reasons was to get rid of the keeper as much as anything else, because he'd become such a nuisance, and the only way they could really do it was to sell the elephant so they could get control of the zoo back.
We're talking with Paul Chambers, and he has written a biography of the most famous elephant ever, Jumbo. So tell us, before we get to talking about Barnum and the sale, how big was Jumbo, and when did he get to be big?
Well, he started off as a runt. One of the reasons the Paris Zoo hated him so much, or I say hated, that's probably wrong, one of the reasons why they ignored him, is probably a better word, is because when they bought him, they thought that he would grow into this magnificent African bull elephant, and he didn't. He stayed a runt. He was only about 4 feet tall. When he was about, so hang on, let's think, he must have been about 5 years old when he arrived in London, and he was 4 feet tall then. Of course, that's not that spectacular. That's only the size of a pony or a horse thing. So people didn't think it was that spectacular at all. But elephants grow, the African elephant, which is slightly different from the Indian ones, grow very quickly in a very short space of time. So actually, shortly after arriving in London and after being properly fed and watered and things, Jumbo began to grow very quickly indeed. And he reached a total height of 11 and a half feet, I think, in the end, which in those days, because there weren't that many African elephants around, and because African bull elephants in particular are very robust, it looked a lot larger than it was. And so he was billed as being the largest elephant in the world, which he wasn't, certainly wasn't. And he might have been, I suppose, the largest elephant in captivity. By the time he left the zoo, he was 11 and a half feet tall, which was, you know, as if you're a Victorian visitor to a zoo and you're stood next to something that's nearly twice as tall as you are, so quite impressive.
How did it happen that Jumbo was sold?
Well, a number of things happened, really. The first was that Matthew Scott had been blackmailing the London Zoo authorities for some considerable time, and I do mean literally blackmailing, in the sense that one of the things he used to do was insist that he kept all the money from Jumbo's. Jumbo used to give rides to children around the zoo at a penny a go, and Scott insisted that he kept all that money, and it was a lot of money. I can't think of the equivalent now, but it was several $100 a year. In fact, it must have been more than that. So it must have been a couple of $1,000 a year. And that's in the 1880s. And that's, you know, if you scale that up now, it's quite a lot of money. So that was one reason. Another reason was Jumbo went through his sort of adolescence and had a spectacular fit of violence, really, because his hormones got a bit out of control. And periodically, elephants, or male elephants, when they're ready to breed, have these periodic rushes of hormones that cause them to behave unpredictably. And Jumbo, over a period of several weeks, almost destroyed his elephant house. I mean, he left parts of it absolutely ruinous. But that's nothing unusual. I mean, the zoos were used to elephants doing that because, you know, they'd had Indian elephants there for years. So they knew how to handle it. And what happened, really, was the superintendent of the zoo was just fed up and at his wit's end and didn't know how he was going to get rid of this troublesome elephant and his troublesome keeper. When Phineas Barnum, the famous circus owner, completely out of the blue, telegrammed the London Zoo and said, would you be prepared to sell Jumbo? And this telegram, it was just before Christmas in 1881, landed on Abraham Bartlett's desk, the superintendent's desk. And really, without consulting anyone, he just said yes and took the first offer that Barnum gave. So he was delighted. He thought, this is going to solve all my problems. Fantastic. Get rid of the elephant, get rid of the keeper. And by that point, even though the elephant was their star attraction, he just wanted the thing gone. But what he didn't count on was the extraordinary reaction of the British public, who loved Jumbo so much that they caused this complete and utter outrage. It's incredible, actually. I mean, going through the newspapers at the time, there are just pages and pages devoted to the fact that Jumbo is being sold to Barnum. You know, it was going to be shipped across to America. It was a complete stink, and there was a court case, and people tried to sue Barnum and tried to sue the zoo, and all those kinds of things went on. But the zoo didn't relent. They said, no, we're definitely going to sell this thing, sell this elephant. And Barnum, on the other side of the Atlantic, who was, I think, probably one of the finest publicity merchants of all time, absolutely delighted in the outrage in Britain and stoked the fires up even more. He, by writing to the British press and claiming that the Americans would treat Jumbo better than the British and this kind of thing, but really ensuring that this outrage continued, because of course it gave him fantastic publicity. But poor old Jumbo, in the middle of all this, was he was just a victim between these two great egos, you know, the superintendent of the London Zoo on one side and Barnum on the other.
And so how did they actually get Jumbo to America?
Well, that was a protracted process as well, because he refused to go initially. I mean, they built this enormous wooden crate, which Jumbo... the idea was to get Jumbo inside it, and then he'd be shipped across by boat. And when the day came, they put the wooden crate in the zoo and asked Matthew Scott to put Jumbo inside it. And in front of an absolutely vast crowd, I think it was about 10,000 people, Jumbo sort of lay down prostrate on the ground and gave this completely piteous act. He refused to move. at all. And of course, that just stoked everything up even further, if the fact that the elephant didn't even want to go, let alone anything else. And they tried a number of times, in fact, over several weeks, tried to get Jumbo into this crate, and he just absolutely refused to go and gave these incredible scenes. I mean, they managed to get him once to the entrance of the zoo, where the plan was, because they'd given up trying to get him into the crate in the end, and they instead planned to walk him down to the docks and put him on the boat in person. They managed to get him to the zoo entrance, and again, this incredible piteous display. He lay down and wouldn't do anything. In the end, Abraham Bartlett realized that part of the problem was actually Matthew Scott. Matthew Scott didn't want Jumbo to go, and that what he had been doing was coaching Jumbo to put on these piteous displays. In the end, the way it was resolved was Bartlett threatened Scott. What he threatened to do, actually, was to separate the two of them. He said to Scott, well, I'm going to remove you from the zoo so that you never get to see Jumbo again. And at that point, Jumbo suddenly cooperated and got in the crate, got on the boat, and even though he was terribly seasick, was taken across to America. And I think he arrived in New York in April 1882, I think it was. But of course, by this point, Barnum's publicity machine had gone into overdrive. The people in America had been whipped up into a frenzy, and so this elephant, when he stepped off the boat into New York, was greeted by, I mean, the newspapers at the time say it was the largest crowd ever assembled in New York, went through the streets lined with people cheering and waving and everything else. And of course, at that point, the story takes over. In America, where Jumbo became, I mean, he was very, very famous in Britain, but he became a sort of megastar, if you like, in America, which is really where a lot of the legacy comes from now.
We're talking with Paul Chambers, and his new book is a biography of the great elephant, Jumbo. And so Matthew Scott came with Jumbo and joined Barnum also?
Yes, that was initially the zoo loaned Matthew Scott for 6 months to Barnum. In the end, Matthew Scott stayed in America permanently. Yes, that was part of the deal. I mean, Jumbo really wouldn't do anything without Matthew Scott, and Matthew Scott couldn't do anything without Jumbo. So, yeah, the two of them came across, and they both became very famous. I mean, Jumbo Scott, as he was known, was just as famous as Jumbo in his own way. And Scott, I mean, he'd been a very prickly character, and not a very pleasant character, I don't think, particularly in some respects, in Britain. And actually, he loved America, and he loved the way of life and things there, and it suited him much better. I think he became, and he used the word advisedly, a bit more mellow over there. I mean, even though they were travelling an awful lot, because Barnum Circus would travel, it was, you know, it would use the railroads to travel all the way around the eastern United States, and they were travelling a lot. But it did seem to suit Scott a lot better. I don't think Jumbo was very happy. I think he found life on the road quite hard going. But anyway, the two of them had each other, and that was the main thing.
And did Jumbo perform tricks and so forth in the circus, or he just was there?
No, he was a figurehead. He had never performed tricks in the zoo. I mean, he and Scott used to have these little routines where Jumbo would playfully steal his hat and throw it into a crowd, and or playfully drink cups of tea or pints of beer or whatever that people had put within reach. But he didn't have any. He couldn't stand on his hind legs or do any of the sort of classic circus tricks and things. When Barnum got him in, he very cleverly incorporated him into this sort of three-ring circus that he had, this great touring circus, which did literally have three rings. And what Jumbo would do, he'd be the sort of the star of the show. He would lead all the other elephants, of which there were quite a few. I can't remember exactly how many, but it was a couple of dozen, I think, that Barnum Circus had. So he would come out all dressed up in a sort of spangly costume and things, with Scott, who by then was equally as famous as Jumbo, with Scott riding him. would come out and do a sort of tour around the outside of the three rings of the circus, leading all the other elephants with him. So he was just a mascot, and but it worked in the sense that his show sold out night after night for ages and ages, and you can see that from the moment Jumbo arrived, he was the star attraction there. All the posters and things are just focused on Jumbo, and everything else is secondary. And he became this huge star. I mean, it was in America that the word Jumbo started to become used for any sort of large object, you know, like a Jumbo, well, we've got now a Jumbo jet or Jumbo hot dogs or whatever.
Jumbo shrimp is our favorite one.
Jumbo shrimps, exactly, all these kind of things. And that came about because, he became so famous in America that he started to, in effect, endorse products. So I think the first one I could find, the first mention, was actually, of all things, a foghorn. It was the Jumbo foghorn, and it just went on from there. People, if they wanted to advertise something, if they wanted to make sure it was big, they put a picture of Jumbo next to it, or they used Jumbo's name, and hence we still use his name now.
Well, how many years did Jumbo tour with P.T. Barnum before his sad demise?
Well, it's all a bit unfortunate, really. He managed 3 years. I mean, what would happen is each March or April, right, sort of early spring, the circus would perform in New York for a few weeks and then go on tour until round about October. So it was quite a punishing schedule, and they would literally arrive in a town, unpack, the circus would go up, do a performance that evening, then they'd pack up and by midnight be back on the railroad and on their way. So it was a punishing schedule, and that was day after day for several months of the year. And then they would rest in Bridgeport for over the winter in Barnum's sort of winter headquarters. So it was a punishing schedule, and as I say, it suited Scott quite well. I don't think it suited Jumbo quite as well. I think he found the travelling very hard. But they managed it for 3 years. And as I say, during that time, Jumbo became this incredible star. And then, unfortunately, I'm trying to think when it was. It was in September 1885. The circus was in St. Thomas in Ontario, in Canada. And they'd performed their nightly show. And the thing was being dismantled. And Jumbo was always one of the last exhibits to be loaded up. I mean, he had his own special car, which had been designed for him, and he was, you know, a bit like, as I say, I keep going back to the celebrity thing, but a bit like a celebrity, he had his own car.
His own trailer.
And all that kind of thing, which he shared with Scott. For reasons best known to themselves, Scott decided to get him back to his car, took a shortcut by actually walking him along the railway line, rather than walking him along the road into the sort of marshalling yard and things. They walked him along the railway line, and which was on a very steep embankment, at the top of a very steep embankment, and lo and behold, a freight train started to come down the line at the same time as they were there. And Scott just couldn't get Jumbo off the line in time because of this very steep embankment down one side. Scott threw himself clear, but the train hit Jumbo. And he lived, I suppose, I think, well, I've got a good description of it, actually. He lived for about 15 minutes afterwards and sadly died of his injuries. And, it was the end of Jumbo's life, and it was terribly sad, and it made headline news around the world, poor old Jumbo's death. It was the start, believe it or not, of another phase in Jumbo's life, because Barnum, never being one to miss a trick, immediately ordered that Jumbo's hide be removed from the body, which took a team of taxidermists weeks to do, and then had him stuffed. And so he carried on touring, because he died at the end of one season. By the beginning of the next season, they had the stuffed Jumbo. And to add insult to injury, Barnum had ordered that they stick in a bit more stuffing to make him look bigger and taller than he actually had been in life.
Well, it's a heartbreaking but also a wonderful story, and it's called Jumbo, and the author is Paul Chambers, my guest tonight on From the Bookshelf. Thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.
the old clock on the wall says that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf, but I'll be back next week with another great show right here on Central Coast Public Radio. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org. And I want to thank Miss Breanne Beal for all of her hard work on the show. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.